A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and honestly, Ermin, I read it 3 times, and it still didn't get less strange. Qatar has gifted the United States a Boeing 747 to serve as Air Force One. The Trump administration accepted it, spent somewhere between $100 and $200 million modifying it, and unveiled it as part of the presidential fleet. On its face, this is either the most generous diplomatic gesture in modern history, or the most obvious national security breach ever conducted in plain sight.
It's the latter. I mean, let's just sit with what's actually happening here. A foreign government, one with documented ties to groups the EU has designated as terrorist organizations, just handed the keys to a jumbo jet and said, "Here, fly the president around in this." And the response was, essentially, "Thanks, what a deal."
The framing from the White House has been that this is a cost-saving measure. Trump himself said the EU would be a fool not to accept a free transport for the commander-in-chief. And I suppose if you squint, if you completely ignore everything we know about presidential security protocols, if you pretend the last 80 years of Air Force One operations never happened, then sure, free plane.
Air Force One isn't a plane, that's the thing. It's a flying nuclear command center. It's a hardened, classified, supply chain vetted fortress with wings. Every rivet, every wire, every chip in the existing VC-25. A fleet was sourced through EU defense contractors with security clearances and decades of oversight. You don't just swap in a Qatari airframe and call it equivalent.
I think this is where the average person might say, "Wait. It's a Boeing. Boeing is an American company. The plane was built in Everett, Washington. How foreign could it possibly be?"
That's exactly the surface-level objection, and it's worth addressing because it's the one the administration is counting on people making. Yes, the airframe was assembled by Boeing in the United States. But here's the thing. A 747 isn't a sealed unit that rolls off the line as a finished product. It's a platform that gets customized. The interior, the avionics suite, the communications gear, the hardening, all of that is installed post-assembly, and the original order for this specific airframe was placed by a Qatari buyer who had their own specifications and their own contractors involved from day one. The supply chain forks the moment a customer says, "I want this configuration."
Even before the first rivet went in, the provenance was already compromised relative to what you'd need for a presidential aircraft.
When the EU orders a VC-25A, the security requirements are baked in at the design phase. The contractor base is pre-cleared. The manufacturing process is monitored. This plane was built for a different customer with a different set of requirements and a different set of eyes on the factory floor. You can't retroactively secure that.
Which brings us to the question Daniel's really asking. Is there any precedent for this? Has the United States ever accepted a gift of this nature from a foreign power? And if the surface story is as transparently absurd as it seems, what's actually going on underneath it?
Let's lay out what we actually know. The plane is a Boeing 747-8I1, the newest, longest-range variant. It was originally ordered by a private Qatari ZIP, reportedly the Emir's brother, for personal use. That deal fell through, the plane sat, and then in 2025, Qatar offered it to the United States.
A hand-me-down from a royal sibling. Already a strong start for the most secure aircraft on Earth.
The hand-me-down then went through what the Pentagon describes as an extensive modification process. New engines, new avionics, secure communications gear, the works. Price tag somewhere between $100 and $200 million. And in June of this year, it was officially rolled out as part of the Air Force One fleet.
We took a foreign prince's unwanted jet, spent up to $200 million taxpayer dollars making it American, and now it's supposedly fit to carry the president through a nuclear crisis. This is the cost-saving measure we were promised.
That's the paradox. The existing VC-25A planes, the current Air Force One fleet, those are 747-200s built from the ground up for this mission. Every component sourced through cleared U contractors, every system designed to presidential specifications from day one. The security model assumes total control over provenance.
Provenance is the word. You can strip a plane to the airframe and rebuild it, but you can't unknow the supply chain. You can't verify every inch of wiring, every sensor, every fastener that was installed in a factory you didn't oversee. The risk isn't just a bug. It's a thing you don't know to look for.
Let me give you an analogy that might make this more concrete. Imagine you're building a house that needs to withstand a siege. You hire a vetted architect, you source every brick from a known quarry, you personally inspect the foundation pour. Now imagine instead someone gives you a mansion that was built for a foreign buyer by contractors you've never met, using materials from suppliers you can't trace. You can renovate the interior, you can install new locks and reinforced windows. But you will never know if there's something in the walls. You will never know if the foundation has a flaw that only the original builder knows about. That's the difference.
In this analogy, the thing in the walls could be a listening device, or it could be a structural vulnerability that someone on the other side of the world knows how to exploit at the worst possible moment. The point is, you don't know, and the nature of presidential security is that we're pretty sure it's fine isn't the standard. The standard is we can prove it's clean.
Which is why I keep coming back to the same question. Who in the national security apparatus looked at this and said yes? The Secret Service, the Air Force, the NSA, the White House Military Office. There's an entire chain of people whose entire job is to say no to exactly this kind of thing.
Yet here we are. Which means we're either missing something, or the people who should have said no were told to sit this one out.
That brings us to the legal question, which is almost as strange as the security one. The Emoluments Clause, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, says no person holding office shall accept any present or emolument from a foreign state without the consent of Congress.
Not any present under a certain value. Not any present unless it's really convenient. The language is absolute. And the framers put that in there for a reason. They just fought a revolution against a monarchy, and they were terrified of foreign influence corrupting the new republic. The idea that a king could buy access to the president by sending him nice things. That was exactly the nightmare scenario.
This isn't a ceremonial vase. This is arguably the largest single gift from a foreign government in you. The airframe alone, before modifications, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 million. The legal workaround the administration used is that the plane was donated to the UDUG government as an entity, not to the president personally.
Which is a distinction that technically exists and practically evaporates the moment a sitting president walks up the stairs. The Emoluments Clause wasn't written to stop foreign kings from handing the president a sack of coins. It was written to stop exactly this, a foreign power embedding itself in the machinery of the executive branch through strategic generosity.
Congress did technically consent, or at least didn't block it, but the consent came through a budgetary mechanism, not a standalone vote. The modification funds were approved as part of a broader defense appropriations package. So the constitutional check happened through a line item in a bill most members probably didn't read closely.
Of course they didn't. And this is the part that really gets me. The constitutional safeguard that was supposed to prevent exactly this scenario was bypassed by burying it in a budget bill. It's like hiding a permission slip in a stack of paperwork and then claiming everyone signed off. The form was observed, but the function was completely hollowed out.
The problem with that approach is it creates a template. If you can bury the consent for a $400 million aircraft in an appropriations bill, you can bury the consent for anything. The next foreign power that wants to donate something strategically sensitive now knows exactly how to do it. Get it into a must-pass budget bill. Make sure the line item is boring enough that no one asks questions.
Let's look at precedent, because Daniel asked about that directly. Has the U ever accepted anything comparable?
The short answer is no. Has accepted foreign donated aircraft before. Training planes for Allied air forces, a few transport aircraft for non-combat roles. But those are tactical assets. They don't carry the commander-in-chief. They don't serve as the airborne seat of government during a crisis.
The closest analog I could find is the transfer of naval vessels between allies. Has both given and received warships through programs like the Lend-Lease Framework or post-war mutual defense agreements. but those of established protocols, decades of precedent, and their warships, not the personal transport of a head of state. A destroyer doesn't carry the nuclear football.
A presidential jet sits in a category with no analog. It's not just a vehicle. It's a symbol of sovereignty. When a foreign leader steps onto Air Force One, they're stepping onto American territory in the most literal diplomatic sense. The idea that the fuselage itself came from a foreign patron creates a symbolic entanglement that no legal workaround can fully dissolve.
Think about the optics of a state visit. The president of France arrives at the White House. The two leaders stand at the podium. And somewhere in the background, parked at Andrews, is a plane that was a gift from Qatar. Every foreign leader who visits knows that. Every ambassador in Washington knows that. It's a permanent billboard for Qatari influence, and it's parked on a U.
Here's what I keep coming back to. The modification process. $100 to $200 million to Americanize the plane. The Pentagon says they stripped it and rebuilt it. New engines, new avionics, new secure communications. But the airframe is the airframe. The wiring harnesses, the structural sensors, the thousands of components embedded in the fuselage during original manufacture, those retain their provenance from a supply chain the U didn't control.
I want to push on that a little, because I think there's a genuine counterargument worth engaging. Couldn't the modification process have been thorough enough? I mean, we're talking about the U. They have some of the best engineers on the planet. If anyone could strip a plane to its skeleton and rebuild it clean, it's them.
It's a fair question, and I've looked into this. The problem isn't the competence of the engineers, it's the physics of the thing. A modern airliner has something like 170 miles of wiring running through its fuselage. Much of that wiring is bundled, routed through bulkheads, sealed behind panels that were installed before the interior was finished. To inspect every inch of it, you'd essentially have to deconstruct the aircraft and rebuild it from scratch, at which point you're spending more than the cost of a new plane.
The choice is between a partial inspection that leaves gaps, or a full teardown that costs more than just buying a new one from Boeing with full security oversight.
And the Pentagon didn't do a full teardown. They did a modification. They swapped major systems. They installed new communications gear. But they didn't unbuild and rebuild the airframe. That means there are components inside that plane whose full history is unknown. And in the world of presidential security, unknown is synonymous with unacceptable, or at least it always has been until now.
This is where the security case really unravels. The existing VC-25. A fleet was built under what's called a special access program. Every contractor, every subcontractor, every sub-subcontractor was vetted. The supply chain was documented to the level of individual fasteners. You can't replicate that by retrofitting a foreign airframe. You can make it safer. You cannot make it equivalent.
Just to put a finer point on this, the special access program for the VC-25A isn't just some bureaucratic checkbox. It means that if a bolt on the current Air Force One was manufactured in Ohio, there's a record of who made it, who inspected it, who transported it, who installed it, and who verified the installation. That's the standard. That's what secure means in this context.
Which means the question isn't really whether this plane is secure enough. The question is why the people who know it isn't secure enough didn't stop it. If the security and legal case doesn't hold up, we have to ask a different question. What does Qatar get out of this?
That's where this goes from strange to genuinely interesting. Because Qatar doesn't do anything by accident. This is a country of about 300,000 citizens sitting on the world's third largest natural gas reserves. They've spent the last two decades converting hydrocarbon wealth into geopolitical relevance, and they're extraordinarily good at it.
They're playing chess while everyone else is playing checkers, and the chessboard is made of liquefied natural gas contracts.
Al Udeid Air Base alone, that's the largest U military installation in the Middle East, 11,000 American personnel, the forward headquarters of CENTCOM. Qatar hosts it. Qatar expanded it on their own dime. That base is the single biggest reason any U administration has to pick up the phone when Doha calls.
Let's not gloss over what expanded it on their own dime means in practice. Qatar spent over $1 billion upgrading Al Udeid, runways, housing, command facilities, all to make themselves indispensable to the U. That's not charity. That's strategic investment. They understood that the deeper the U footprint, the harder it would be for Washington to ever walk away from the relationship.
Now they've added a 747 with a presidential seal on it to the portfolio. It's the physical manifestation of the phone call they know will get answered.
Let's talk about what Qatar actually wants. The most immediate thing is F-35s. They've been lobbying for them for years. The UAE got them. Israel has them. Qatar wants to be in that club. And the State Department has been slow-walking the sale over concerns about Qatar's relationships with Iran and various Islamist groups.
Qatar shares the world's largest gas field with Iran. They have to maintain a working relationship with Tehran. It's existential for them. But from a U perspective, that same relationship makes a fifth-generation stealth fighter sale deeply uncomfortable. You don't want your most advanced combat aircraft potentially compromised through a back channel to Tehran.
This is where the regional politics get really tangled. Qatar also has a complicated history with its Gulf neighbors. Saudi Arabia and the UAE imposed a blockade on Qatar from 2017 to 2021, partly over these exact issues. Qatar's ties to Iran, its support for Islamist groups, its independent foreign policy. The blockade failed. Qatar emerged stronger. And now Qatar is demonstrating that it doesn't just have regional leverage. It has leverage in Washington that its neighbors can't match.
That's where the plane becomes leverage. Not leverage in the crude sense. Nobody's writing a memo that says gift plane, receive F-35s. But in the world of diplomatic signaling, a $400 million aircraft creates an obligation. It's a gift that sits on the tarmac at Joint Base Andrews, visible every time the president boards or disembarks. You can't forget it. You can't unsee it.
It's the bribe in plain sight problem. And I want to be precise here. I'm not saying this is a bribe in the legal sense. The legal workarounds we discussed earlier exist precisely to prevent it from meeting that definition. But the functional effect is indistinguishable. Qatar transfers an asset of enormous value. The United States accepts it. The administration now has a relationship with Doha that is materially different than it was before the transfer.
The timing matters. Qatar has spent over $100 million on EU lobbying since 2017. They've hired former Trump administration officials. They've cultivated relationships across both parties. This isn't a one-off gesture. It's the capstone of a decade-long influence campaign.
The lobbying spending is the context that makes the plane make sense. $100 million in lobbying buys you access. A $400 million plane buys you something closer to partnership. And if you're Qatar, you're looking at the return on investment here, and it's actually pretty remarkable. $100 million in lobbyists plus a plane you already owned and couldn't use, against multi-billion dollar arms deals and a permanent seat at the table. That's not a bad trade.
There's also the mediator angle. Qatar has positioned itself as the indispensable go-between for the UN groups it can't talk to directly. Hamas, the Taliban, elements in Iran. They hosted the Taliban's political office in Doha for years. They were central to the hostage negotiations after October 7th. Every time the EU needs a back channel in the region, Qatar is there.
Being the mediator is a form of power. It makes you essential. The plane is insurance that nobody in Washington forgets how essential you are. It's a reminder cast in aluminum and jet fuel.
There's a deeper theory I've seen from analysts who cover this region closely. The gift might not be about any specific quid pro quo at all. It might be a test.
A test of what?
Of how far Qatar can push. Of whether the EU security establishment is capable of saying no to a sufficiently generous patron. If you're Qatar, and you're wondering whether your influence campaign is working, you don't send a fruit basket. You send a jumbo jet. If the EU accepts it, you have your answer.
That's a chilling way to think about it. But it tracks. A fruit basket tells you whether someone likes you. A jumbo jet tells you whether the institutional safeguards that are supposed to protect national security are still functioning. If they are, the plane gets politely declined. If they aren't, you've just learned something enormously valuable about the state of the EU.
The answer appears to be yes. The security establishment either signed off or was overruled. Either way, the plane is here.
Let me ask you this. If it was a test, what's the next test? If you're Qatar, and you've just confirmed that you can embed a strategic asset into the EU presidential fleet, what do you try next?
That's the question that should keep people up at night. Because the answer is, probably something we haven't thought of yet. The whole point of a test like this is to find the boundary. And right now, the boundary appears to be somewhere beyond a $400 million aircraft.
What makes this different from something like the Statue of Liberty, which Daniel mentioned as a comparison, is that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from the people of France to the people of the United States. It was symbolic. It had no operational function. It didn't carry the president. It didn't embed a foreign supply chain into the nuclear command and control architecture.
The Freedom Bell from Germany, same category. These are monuments. They sit in parks. They don't fly through hostile airspace with a nuclear football on board.
Even the Statue of Liberty had its critics at the time. There were people who said, wait, we're accepting a massive gift from a foreign government. What's the catch? But the catch, if there was one, was soft power. The kind of thing that plays out over generations. This is different. This is hard power. Operational. Immediate.
A functional presidential aircraft is a different category of gift entirely. It's not a symbol of friendship, it's an instrument of the state. And the idea that a foreign power provided that instrument should trouble anyone who thinks seriously about sovereignty.
There's one more layer here that I think is worth naming. The plane was originally ordered for the Emir's brother, a private royal asset that became a state gift. That trajectory, from personal luxury good to diplomatic instrument, is itself revealing. It suggests the decision to gift it wasn't some long-planned strategy. It was opportunistic. The deal fell through. The plane was sitting there, and someone in Doha realized it could be repurposed as the largest calling card in diplomatic history.
Which actually makes it more concerning, not less. A carefully planned gift would at least imply some deliberation about the implications. An opportunistic one suggests Qatar saw an opening and took it, and the EU didn't have the reflexes to say no.
The fact that it was opportunistic also tells you something about the state of play in Doha. They had a $400 million asset sitting idle, and they thought, we can get more value out of this by giving it away than by selling it. That's not normal cost-benefit thinking. That's the kind of calculation you make when you're playing a much longer game.
Here's the practical question for anyone watching this story unfold. What should we actually be looking for next?
The first thing is whether this plane ever carries a sitting president on an actual mission. Not a photo op at Andrews. Not a ceremonial flight to a summit. A real deployment where the nuclear football is on board and the plane is functioning as the airborne command post it's supposed to be.
If it never does, if it gets quietly relegated to vice presidential travel or cabinet delegations, that tells you the security establishment knows exactly what they have, which is a plane that's fine for optics and useless for its stated purpose.
That's the tell. The gap between the unveiling ceremony and the operational reality. The Pentagon can stand at a podium and say this aircraft meets all standards, but the flight logs don't lie. Watch where it goes and who's on it.
The second thing to watch is Qatar's weapons requests. They've been after F-35s for years. If that sale gets approved in the next 12 to 18 months, the connection will be circumstantial but awfully hard to dismiss. A $400 million plane followed by a multi-billion dollar fighter deal. At some point, the pattern is the story.
The third thing is the precedent this sets. That's what I keep coming back to. If Qatar can gift a presidential jet, what's the limiting principle? Saudi Arabia could offer a naval destroyer. The UAE could offer a secure communications satellite. South Korea could offer a cyber warfare platform. Once you've established that foreign-donated strategic assets are acceptable, the category expands indefinitely.
Each one creates the same entanglement, the same implicit obligation, the same supply chain questions. We need a framework for this that doesn't currently exist, something clearer than the emoluments clause workaround we saw here, something that forces a public congressional vote rather than a buried line item.
The framework question is the long-term one. In the short term, the thing to watch is simply whether anyone in Congress takes this up. A GAO report. Anything that signals the oversight machinery is awake. Because right now, the silence is almost as loud as the plane.
I think the silence is instructive in its own way. Congress is not shy about holding hearings on things that serve their political interests. The fact that this hasn't generated a single high-profile hearing suggests either that both parties see some benefit in letting it slide, or that the lobbying apparatus has been effective enough to keep it off the agenda.
It's probably both.
The broader point this leaves us with is that the line between diplomacy, bribery, and national security is thinner than we like to think. It's not a bright line. It's a gradient, and a $400 million aircraft pushes you pretty far along it. The next time you hear about a gift between nations, ask yourself what the real price is, because there is always a price.
Here's the thing that I think will stick with me longest from this whole story. We started by asking whether this was a security breach or a diplomatic gesture, but those aren't mutually exclusive. Something can be both. A gift can be generous and compromising at the same time. That's what makes this so hard to talk about in clean terms. The ambiguity is the point.
The ambiguity is the weapon. If it were obviously a breach, someone would have stopped it. If it were obviously benign, we wouldn't be talking about it. It lives in the gray zone, and the gray zone is where influence operations thrive.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, Soviet biologists working near the Aral Sea Basin advanced a since-abandoned theory that tardigrades were not animals at all, but a transitional life form between plants and fungi, citing their cryptobiotic desiccation as evidence of a third kingdom of terrestrial life.
Right. I'm going to need you to explain cryptobiotic desiccation at some point, but not today. This has been My Weird Props. Our thanks to producer Hilbert Flemingtop and to Daniel for the prompt that launched this whole unsettling journey. If you want to send us your own questions, ideally ones that don't involve foreign powers gifting strategic aircraft, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.